Now, an Irishman who has learned to talk to dogs says our four-legged friends have a more advanced communication system than humans. Dog whisperer Martin McKenna, good morning.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
Very good indeed. And it's great to speak to you, Martin. What part of the country are you from?
I'm from Limerick, in Garryowen in Limerick.
And you're currently in Australia, aren't you?
Yeah, I live in a rainforest, actually, up here in Nimbin. It's like a huge caldera, a big, huge mountain called Mount Warnin, blew itself apart a couple of hundred thousand years ago and left a huge caldera. And it's like one big, huge rainforest.
What took you out there?
Dingoes.
Simple as that.
Hello?
Yep, sorry, dingoes, I was just absorbing that information, Martin.
I came up here because of dingoes. I've been fascinated by dogs since I was a tiny little baby. I'm one of genetically identical triplet boys, and we were born in 1962. And my father called us a litter of pups because no one had seen triplets before, Greg, right?
Mm.
And I was very, very sick when I was born. I only weighed about a pound and a half, you know. And back then they didn't have incubators, so they put you into a little box with a little, you know, oxygen thing and then a bit of a glow lamp on top. And, yeah, if he survives, he survives. If he doesn't, he doesn't, you know. And so my father nicknamed me the runt. But the problem was, right, when I was born, I had no immune system. So
yeah.
I never seen anyone's face until I was about 4 months old. And when I got home, my mother, who was a German woman, one of the Bollingers, the champagne makers, she said when you came home, and she would try to pick me up, I'd start screaming, like, because I wasn't used to human faces or anything. And, you know, to thicken the plot, we had two German shepherds, Greg. And she would say, I would put you down with the two German shepherds, und schlafen Kinder. The child would go asleep, and she'd leave me there with the dogs, do you know? I kind of prefer.
So did you then get,
like,
I mean, no, you then formed an affinity with dogs, I'm not saying over humans necessarily, but certainly beyond what...
I would.
Okay, that's good. Well, we'll go there then. So you then felt more comfortable in the company of dogs?
Yeah. Look, I used to crawl around them all the time, so I wouldn't walk. And I think my mother said I walked at about five or something. You know, I wouldn't walk and I wouldn't talk. And I wouldn't do anything that was human, you know. I was kind of a strange baby, you know. We were all premature, and I was extremely premature. So we now know, like, the premature babies, especially the very premature ones, are very strange. And I think
you're saying that, not me.
yes, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, the strangeness, Greg, is a kind of like a hypersensitivity.
Yeah.
You don't exactly know what's going on, so you're taking disparate pieces of information from everywhere around you. And you're trying to patch together your own little world. And it doesn't look the same as other people's world. And so that's the difference.
Like. Now, you are a dog whisperer of much renown in Australia. What is dog whispering?
Sure, I never whispered anything to a dog in my life, sure.
That's what they call it, don't they? But sure, how do you communicate with them then?
And body language. It has all got to do with body language, energy and smells. Body language of a dog is that very similar to humans. We all seem to have the same flight, greeting and aggression signals in us. I'll give you an example. If you stare at a dog, it will blink its eyelids really fast, and then it'll start licking its lips, and then it'll yawn, and then it'll put its head down to the side. I was in Sydney one time when I was doing one of my books. I've done four books. And I decided to do a little experiment on the train, Greg. So I'm a big, ugly man, right? And I've got huge dreadlocks, right? That's why they call me the dreadlock dog man. And I start staring at this fella across the train, you see, in a very angry way. And I got lots of scars all over me and everything, right? And this fella's looking back at me and he's going, oh, my God, this guy's staring at me. What's the first thing he does? He starts blinking his eyelids. He's got nothing under his eyelids. He's just trying to give me a signal. Please stop staring at me. You're making me very nervous. The next thing he does is he starts licking his lips. The reason he does that is because he's taking in so much oxygen now because he's hyperventilating. And the reason he's yawning is because he's not letting out the carbon monoxide. And so that's making him sleepy. But still, Marty won't break his stare. The last thing the man across the train does is put his chin down to the side. And then I walked over to the guy and I said, look, I'm very sorry. I said, I was doing a bit of a social experiment. I'm doing a documentary proffering the idea that dogs had a language before humans, and humans more or less learned the etiquette from dogs. And that is exactly
Your point was proven there. So how can we employ and communicate with our animals? And we are a nation of animal lovers for the most part, frankly.
They're the greatest people in the world with animals.
So how can we better communicate with our dogs?
Okay, it is all about body language. And the first thing we have to learn about body language is signals for a game, okay? This whole thing with us with dogs is one big game. And the dog looks at us, and the first moment it wakes up in the morning, it goes, game on. If I can get you to do more things than me during the day, dogs are very good counters, you know that?
Yeah.
And that's right. If I can get you to do more things for me during the day, then I have the right to not listen to you. I'll give you one example, okay? You're playing with your dog out the back with a bit of tug of war, with a bit of rope or whatever it is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking away there and you're going, I'm going to win this. And of course you get sick of it after a while, right? So you decide, I'm going inside for a cup of tea or a beer, right? So you look out the window, right? And the dog's running around the backyard with a bit of stuff in its mouth, you know?
Dog one, human
like, we're looking at it. Yeah, and we're looking at him. We're going, what you doing, you stupid dog? And the dog goes, I'm not stupid, it's you. This is my victory lap. Because it won the thing off us. You know, after the GAA All-Ireland final, right? When everyone runs around the field with the trophy, okay? Well, that's the same thing with the dog, right? And what it's saying to you is, you're lazy, you gave up too easy, you didn't even understand there was a game on, I'm winning 52-0 and you don't even know there's a game. No, serious part no, right? So, the dog's running around with it in its mouth and it's done its victory lap. Now it brings the trophy. It's not a toy, it's a trophy, Greg. And then it brings it over to its trophy cabinet. Now, listeners will be familiar with this when they see their dog with four or five old bits of toys and stuff gathered around in the corner of the yard. And sometimes if you go to clean it up, you see they go, grrr, and you go, oh, Jesus, Rover, I'm only trying to clean up your toys. And Rover looks at you and goes, get away from them, you thief.
Hmm.
I won them fair and square off the whole family throughout the day. That's my trophy cabinet by the side gate. And anyone that comes in through that gate is going to look at that and go, oh, Jesus, Rover, you're a winner. I'm not going to talk to them people at all. I'm going to spend all the attention on you. Now, that is a clear example of showing what it is, a game.
Mm.
Okay? Now, I said a little while ago there, from the first moment we open our eyelids. That's very important, Greg. Every day is a brand new day in the dog's world. Okay? There is no tomorrow. Just wakes up and, oh, there it is, the new day. And we come running up to it, you see. And he goes, Rover, did you sleep all right last night? And Rover goes, 1-0.
Mm-hmm.
Because you went to Rover instead of Rover going
right,
to you.
We could go on about this all day, but I can't because of time constraints,
sure.
Because I could sit listening to it all day. My dog jumps up on me, right? And I can't get it to stop. What do I do? And it's such a playful dog,
first,
do you know what I'm
saying? Quickly. Right, now, quickly, first of all, the reason the dog jumps up on you is it's got scent pads in the bottom of its feet.
Yes.
Okay? And it's leaving marks on your chest. And it's saying, any other dog that smells you anywhere now will smell my pads on you and know that I'm more important
right.
to you. Second thing, what it's doing is it's saying, pay attention to me right
well,
now.
Well, I know that,
example.
Yeah.
You know, you've just come home from work, right? Or you've just come back from the shop.
Now, it's not jumping up constantly like, you know, trying to scrape or lick. It's literally just would like to stand leaning against you the whole time.
Oh, leaning against you, that's another wonderful thing, you see, because what it's done now, you see, it's taken your personal space away.
Yeah, that's totally
all in the
true.
Nicest possible way, as Kenny Everett would say, right? What it does is then it leans in on top of you, you move your space, and you think, oh, that's, was I in your way there, Rover? And Rover goes, no, not really, I just wanted to take your space, because you give me another point. Simple thing you do, what I do when my dogs come running towards me, I get this energy coming off me, and I flick my chin to the side and upwards. And I go, get away from me. I wouldn't be caught dead right now near you.
So
I've been out at work all day. I pay the bills. I pay the mortgage. What is it you do again? Now, there is a reason for doing that, Greg. Because dogs live in a smell world.
Right.
You know when dogs wag their tails, Greg?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And everybody thinks, oh, the dog is happy. Well, it's not really that happy. What it's doing is, it's letting little smell texts, you know, like a text message.
Yes.
But this is a smell text out of its bottom. right? Okay. Put a message in it, okay? And it fans its tail like that to get the message fanned out as much as it can. So we seem to think that, oh, you're very happy, Rover, but he's not. He's just sending out messages. Could I do one very important one, and it's why an awful lot of children get bitten. We all are intent on hugging the dog, okay? Mm. And we think that it's a love thing to do. Well, the dog looks at you, and it goes, have you lost your marbles? Did you just try to do a fight hold on me there? Because in my world, I don't think of your nice warm hug as a human thing. I think of it as you were just trying to fight me. Now, if someone were to come up and hug me unknown to me, I'd turn around and bloody nip them. Now, we think to ourselves, Greg, right? We then think afterwards when the dog pulls backwards and licks us on the face and we say, oh, the doggy's kissing us. And of course, the dog isn't kissing you at all. The dog is leaving a chemical message on your nose that it thinks you can read, which says, whoa, we nearly had a fight there. Please, you have to understand that hugging in our world. Have you ever seen two dogs play fighting?
Mm.
Where they get up on each other's shoulders and hug each other around the neck?
Mm.
Well, you see, that's their version of that.
So we're misreading the signals, Martin. Very finely, and if you can, in maybe a couple of seconds.
Sure.
Dogs barking constantly. Is there a way to sort of try and stop that?
Right. What we have to understand first is the reason that dogs bark and it really annoys us over any other noise that we hear is that when we lost our sense of hearing and smell, we relied upon the dog to keep us safe from predators, which meant that they would bark so that something couldn't get close enough to bite us or to eat us. Come up to the modern day, every time we hear a dog bark, that's why that piercing thing inside our head. Little things about barking. If you have a dog, don't put it out the front. If you put it out the front, you're saying to it, you're on duty, I want you to bark at everything that passes. Okay. Number two, leave your dog inside wherever you can. Three, don't shout out the door at your dog, shut up, you stupid dog, because the dog thinks you're only barking along with it. Oh, you're barking along with the, against that thing too. Lovely stuff, right? So, like, what we're saying is, like, get out there, have a look around, okay? If it's not, if it's something you don't want to be worried about, turn around to the dog, put the roof on, tongue on the roof of your mouth, close your mouth, and do this. Down to the dog, and what you're saying is, you got me up out of my comfortable position to come out here for what? They're not the enemy. One of the major reasons that dogs bark is, every time you take a dog for a walk, right, it'll usually do a wee outside your gate, okay? And it'll do wheeze up and down the road, and you think, oh, Jesus, Rover, have you got a bladder problem? And he goes, no, not really. He says, I'm buying real estate.
Yeah.
See, every time he does a wee, he goes, I own this patch of territory, I own this patch of territory. Then they do a pee right on the door, on the gate outside before they come in. They're brought inside. Another strange dog will come down the road and go, oh, no, you're not buying that real estate. I'm buying that real estate.
And it's a circle that goes
and it'll
on
do
forever.
A wee over it.
Yeah.
And that's why the reason why a lot of dogs bark. They're pee issues, you know? It's called pee males.
Right, okay. Martin McKenna, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'd love to talk
could
about
just
your...
Could I quickly mention the book?
That's exactly what I was going to do, but go ahead, you.
And... I'm amazed. I did my memoir was published in New York through the Writer's House in Manhattan, and 'tis published through Skyhorse in New York, and 'tis called The Boy Who Talked to Dogs. And one of the things I wanted to get out to people with it was, do you know, I speak to an awful lot of street kids. I was a street kid myself. I speak to an awful lot of street kids, and the one thing I try and tease them is, learn through your dog. Your dog is your guru, not me, not anybody else, your dog. Your dog is the one that can smell you, sense you, can understand when you're happy, sad, confused, can indeed show you a way. And I have YouTube sites called the Dreadlock Dogman down here in Australia, and they're the wackiest sites with the wackiest dogs. And if people would like to look at it, there's an awful lot of information, and there's a free blog.
Listen, a caller says that fella's got far too much energy for this time of the morning. But sure, it's not the morning where you are anyway, Martin. And it's great to, it's been great speaking to you and to get some of that energy off you. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme, Martin.
Thank you.
And we'll
so
direct
much
people
indeed.
We'll direct people to where they can get your books and the YouTube links as well. And I'd love to talk to you about the dingoes and that, but I just don't have time. But thanks so much, Martin.
Another time.
Okay,
thank
take
you.
Care. Okay, we learned during the week that the government has approved a bill requiring calories on menus. The proposals require food outlets to post the information at the point where the food is ordered. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined on the programme this morning by the No Salt chef, Brian McDermott. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Greg.
Well, you're a chef. What do you think of this proposal?
I think it can be a good thing, Greg, but I think there's a long journey between now and it actually in place in 2016. I also think it's going to be a very tough and challenging aspect of what the government want restaurants to do, because let's just take a couple of things into consideration. Firstly, this is already in place in a number of establishments, some of the bigger branded sort of fast food style of restaurants, it's there. So if you stop at that for a moment and ask yourself the question, how often do you actually check the calories of that meal that you're actually ordering? So has it had any effect so far? Arguably no. You know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not sure. But secondly, if we move on into sort of the restaurant trade as well, I mean, it's going to be very, very difficult, because for those guys to put a calorie count on dishes that they're creating and being innovative every day, that's the reason people go to these restaurants with the top chefs, because they're so innovative with local produce. It's going to be scientifically quite difficult for them to put a calorific value on the menu.
Well, so we'll come back.
Will you go on the basis of the calorie count of a dish?
Yeah.
Or the perception of a restaurant?
Well, we'll come back to that if you don't mind. But firstly, you know, and I'm not trivializing it, but if I want to treat myself to, you know, a big greasy kebab once every now and again, or in a restaurant if I want to have the most luxurious of desserts, do I really want to be faced with this health information when I'm giving myself a treat?
I'm not so sure you do. You know, the other side of it as well, Greg, is that, you know, your choice, your lifestyle, your diet dependent on calories. How many people actually understand calories? You know, surely the government should take initiative to maybe have this starting point right at the other end, because remember, they're doing this to tackle obesity. We have a growing problem. We've had this problem. It's been there for 20 years. Nothing has effectively worked yet. And once again, I mean, I've continually said it, I think we're missing the key point, which is actually the cookery skills of getting people to cook and take control of their own foods, their own meal plans and all of that. The fact that you are going to see that label, you've treated yourself. Remember, your eating occasions are as follows. If you're eating out tonight, it's more than likely going to be a social eat out for an occasion. So do you want the calorific value punch through to you at that stage that you're going to say, do you know what, I'm going to leave that dessert?
Well, you know, that's the conversation that's going to be happening around the dinner table. And you know, as I say, for many of us, to get out for a meal is a treat and a rare treat at that. And, you know, who necessarily wants to have to sit looking at how bad something potentially could be for you?
Yeah.
I mean, if you were to be consuming it three times a day every day.
Yeah, and I think most of us know that. I mean, I think we know if we, for example, gain a little bit of weight, it's down to very poor diet on our own behalf and our own controllability factor of that. But again, I mean, there's different demographics of people here that we're talking about. You know, when you look at poor diet and how it affects, you know, everyone from the working class right through, most people know when they're gaining weight that it's their own fault based upon dietary and what they're eating. So we've got to take control ourselves. But initiatives like this by the government, I don't think they're quite helpful right now at the moment. And I also think that this will actually put little independent owner-operator-style food businesses out of businesses.
And you make a good point earlier on as it relates to the fact that this information is already available in many, many chains. Let's take, for example, really the key area where we possibly should be focusing in terms of obesity, and that's in the young people, because we know if you're obese at a young age, it can have an effect on your health into later life. How many children or how many young adults in their lunch break are going into these fast food outlets and taking any consideration of the calorie count that's being displayed? In other words, it's about education, as you've somewhat indicated to already.
Yeah, because most of those young people, number one, they can't and they don't understand the calorific value and what it actually means. I mean, surely there's a piece of work there in us saying that if you go for a walk based on a nice pace and the weight that you are currently, you know, that you will burn off this amount of calories. I think we're starting at the wrong end. I think if that's the information that's brought through in relation to how do we burn off these calories to get into better health ourselves, and more importantly, that vital thing that continues by government to be forgotten about is the basic cookery skills of going back to proper produce, growing locally in the area, a little bit of cooking, getting control of food back into the home setting. That will lead its way back into the school. It's well supported within the primary schools. That's the dangerous age where obesity is starting to take place. It's that primary school going into secondary school. So schools are certainly doing their job. There's a piece of work to be done at the home. That needs to be encouraged by government-led initiatives, not one which is slightly scientific, that could absolutely kill the food industry, the restaurant game, and I'm talking about good restaurants where you're going to go out and socially enjoy a meal this evening. Mm. You know, you've your quick service restaurants that we indicated earlier. They currently have calorific value, which tells you the amount of calories in a sandwich that you're ordering, whether it be a burger, takeaway, or any of that. You know, why are people not, are maybe surprised to hear that they already have it? It's because they keep the information so small, they keep it so secret, and very little people will actually take a look at that, because the people that understand calorific values are likely not to be in those style of restaurants.
Well, let's get back then to the creativity, the complications maybe for a chef, and putting that to one side, even the difficulty in identifying how many calories are in any given dish, because, you know, in many cases, you're bringing ingredients from all over the place. So how do you determine a calorific count?
Well, from the chef's point of view or from a restaurant's point of view, whether that is a cafe or a fine dining establishment this evening, for them to put a calorie count on their menu, they need to come up with a formatted recipe. Now, that means actual grams and actual weights. Then they've got to put a recommended guide in terms of the portion size. There's a couple of problems immediately there, because it depends on the style and the type of dish and the consistency of one chef changing to another chef tomorrow night. So weights and all of that will differ. So getting that piece right and putting that together is a piece of work that needs to start for them, by them now before 2016. Then they've got to send it out to an expert to get the calorific value. There's only two ways to do that. Number one, it can be done in theory, which is a database pre-program. The likes of myself, I've just purchased that database. So, for example, I can now take anyone's recipe, providing they give me the recipe. Will chefs release the recipe? You know, they need to, if this is going to become a legal requirement.
You're talking there about a fixed menu, but what about restaurants that would have, you know, one-off specials or, you know, lunchtime specials and what have you? I mean, is the effort going to be worth it to calculate the calories on a unique dish?
Well, in my opinion, will they gain any extra revenue as a result of having calorie values on their menu? No, I genuinely believe no. But yes, it's going to be so difficult to do that. But what I believe, without seeing any further information on this, is that they will have to take just their core menu. Mm-hmm. So, example, do their core menu. If they have a daily special on today, they can give a guide based on other dishes that have been calorific valued at that stage. So that is what I believe at the moment. Well, maybe the outcome there to address the daily specials.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, that seems like a little bit of common sense. Finally, too, you know, you have different chefs that some may choose butter or other very fat-rich ingredients or calorie-rich ingredients, and others won't. Do you see a situation where on what any given street it's going to be like a fight for customers via calories and, you know, maybe the taste of the food may suffer or the individual style may suffer?
I think there definitely is a place in any town that will show the calorific value and attract a certain clientele, a customer. The one that you mentioned in relation to, you know, the classical chef who was taught with the creams, the butters and the salts and all of that, you know, a simple steak, just take a favorite dish, which may be just a sirloin steak, possibly with maybe some fried onions or French fried onions, some dauphinoise potatoes and a peppered sauce. You know, there's cheese in there, there's cream, there's multiples of butter and salt. You could be looking at 1,500, you know, calorie count in there. There's no restaurant that's going to want to flag that up.
Yeah.
You know, in the event of that being possibly their best-selling product going to zero sales. So I think this is going to be a huge, huge challenge by the government, and I don't think it's been thought through. And again, I believe they've ignored the main problem with obesity.
Okay.
And again, that needs to go back to the retailers and the multiples as well, who are playing a huge part with the processed foods.
And I'm sure there's people listening that will feel that this is just another case of the nanny state. But for now, Brian McDermott, the No Salt Chef. Chef, thank you so much for joining us in the programme.
Thank you.
Caller says, we all know what we're eating. This is going to stop people going to restaurants. Does the government not have enough to be doing or more important matters? On Twitter, JP says, America has calories on menus. Most obese nation on earth. What a load of rubbish. Fiona says, I think it's a great idea. It definitely makes me think twice when calories are displayed. Low Glutton Diet says there are too many conflicting ideas out there about behaviour like Paleo Atkins.
Let me see, where are there are some other ones here. Look, on Twitter, it's hard to sort of track them down, to be completely honest with you. But we'll get to those later on in the show. But thank you so much to everyone who contributed to that piece. 086 77 00 555 is the text line, 0749 125000. You can tweet me at Greg Hughes 2 or just use the hashtag on Twitter, Weekend Edition. Okay, coming up on the Weekend Edition now, I'm joined in studio by Little Hours, who are John Doherty and Ryan McCluskey, both from Killybegs. Lads, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
We were just saying off air there how you'd taken this weekend off to get some sleep. You've been here since 9:30, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Otherwise.
Very good. It's been a fantastic time for you lately, we'll get to that, but tell us how you began, or how long have you been playing together, or how long has it been officially Little Hours?
Since last year. We only started at the beginning of the year when we came together. We'd been playing in cover bands before, but it was only when we kind of joined up and showed each other our own original stuff that we thought, well, this is kind of good. And literally from, I think, January and then into March, we went straight into the studio with our two songs,
yeah,
and recorded them in Attica, just up the road from here.
The thing, though, about being a musician, you have to make money, and you're talking about you've been in the cover bands, and that's the bread and butter if you're going to be professional and not necessarily have to work during the week, although you probably do that as well.
Yeah.
You'd have to, I presume, do the Little Hour stuff alongside that, because you have to pay the bills too.
Yeah, I've been working full-time as a software engineer for the past year, so that was kind of, a lot of the income was coming from there, which was great. I actually just finished up my job 2 days ago to give this a proper go. So I've a bit of money saved up as well. But along the way, because at the start, things are kind of more expensive and you've less people helping you out, that there's a lot of things like PR, like just general promotion, and then just things like that, buying CDs and stuff that you have to pay for. And the job was great for that, but it's time to give it a proper go now.
It's great for me as well. I'm a music student in Dublin, so it works out pretty well.
So, Ryan, were you bankrolling John?
That's pretty much how it's going. I drive the car and I pay the bills, don't I, John?
Well, listen, when you're making the millions, you can sort it out then, it'll be fine.
I'll pay back then.
Yeah.
So, obviously, too, in the cover bands, and I'm not going to keep reflecting on that, but it's just a kind of an interesting transition then, because then you both share each other's music. Mm. Was there contrasting styles there, or was it surprisingly similar, or did the two knit together, or...?
Well,
I think we're kind of lucky.
Pretty similar.
We'd very similar tastes. I mean, Van Morrison... kind of other alternative stuff like Bon Iver, and then some Irish stuff like Hozier, James Vince McMorrow, Damien Rice, and that kind of stuff. That's a lot of Irish artists, but we actually had the same taste anyway, so it wasn't a matter of sitting down and being like, no, this is what we've got to sound like. We both just kind of agreed, and it stayed the same since.
And what about the writing process? Did you both come into this with songs that you've already written? I mean, I know we're going to be hearing the It's Still Love single. Mm-hmm. Is that a collaboration, or is it one of...
It's funny how the EP came together, that It's Still Love and Tired, the first two tracks, were actually songs that John came to me with. Mm-hmm. And then the next two tracks, Crossfire and Ember, were the tracks I came to John with. But we co-wrote both of them.
I'm not going to lie to you, lads. Yeah. This is not very rock and roll here. There's an awful lot of peace and cooperation. And good
yeah, it's really weird. It's
not, I mean,
it's,
I was one. I want a guitar smashed here and artistic differences.
It's not as glamorous as you'd imagine. It's tea and biscuits, and that's how the writing starts. There's no whiskey or anything.
So when did you realise we're onto something here? Who picked up on it, or when did you? What was the path there, John?
I suppose we always sort of knew we wanted to write our own music, and it was always something that we were definitely going to do at some stage. So whenever we both had our own songs and we came to each other with them and realised that it worked, we just decided to go from there. And
we did then, because we had released the songs off our own back. Our idea actually at the start was funny. I was under the impression that you could make it just online by releasing your stuff and having a decent video and stuff. And I was like, gigging, you know, it's whatever, you know. And then it came about we were completely wrong. Yeah. And that's when we got the shout to do Electric Picnic off that competition. So that's kind of where it kicked off. We did our first gig was at Electric Picnic.
That's, what do they say, a baptism of fire. I mean, what was the buzz like with that?
Yeah, it was
amazing.
It was
like,
unreal.
It was very strange because we hadn't thought really about gigging, and we entered the competition just thinking, yeah, whatever, we'll throw it into that. And then we got it, and we're like, oh, right, we're playing Electric Picnic now.
So is it fair to say that you've exceeded your expectations to some extent? And that,
yeah,
you know,
we're
like,
still,
I mean, it seems that the targets were like here, and what's happening is
above, way above that.
Yeah, because we were just kind of like, oh, we'll go with the flow and see, like, what
if we
happens.
Get, if we get maybe 100,000 hits on YouTube, maybe get a few quid off it, or...
That's kind of what the idea was, to just let it kick off on YouTube. But...
So how did the Meteor Choice Music Prize nomination come around? I mean, that's...
That's
pretty
really, I mean,
impressive, isn't it?
Things are already going well.
We try not to think about what we're doing.
Yeah, but you're going to have to, because it's a radio interview.
Yeah. We're just kind of...
It just happened, lads. Let's hear the music.
Yeah, try to take it one day at a time. And,
But it's, I mean, we're getting some great support before Christmas, playing with Tom Baxter and James Bay, and guys are doing really well at the minute. And then, so we were happy enough, and we got the Pepper Canister booked in, that's happening next week, but... Then the Meteor Choice just came out of nowhere. We just got an email and said, you've been nominated for this.
Because I have a feeling that you could get to the stage where, you know, you're getting booked, and do you have the original material yet, if you know what I mean? And not because you don't have it within you, but because, you know, a lot of bands would have 30, 50, 40 songs, you know, and they haven't had the one that made it. But yous have got one very early on that's sort of got the attention.
The first song.
So the pressure's on start writing now, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Big time.
Because you need an album.
That's what I mean. Yeah, we're flat out writing at the minute. But like you said, the pressure's on for us to kind of deliver now. Because
but what
people,
a great place to be in.
Yeah, it is. It's brilliant. Yeah. There's sometimes you wish you had an extra 5 months to disappear and just go and write all them songs. But we're actually doing pretty good. Like when we said we're taking breaks and stuff, we're writing for about 10 hours yesterday, and it's not like writer's block. We're actually coming up with things all the time. It's good.
Do you write about personal experiences, or, you know, I mean, I'd be uncomfortable with that, because, you know, there's only so much you want people to know about yourself, and maybe your best song ever could be literally what you wouldn't tell anyone.
It's funny that people don't pick up on the most obvious things that you're saying. Whoever's listening,
she
stop,
left me
stop.
And I still love her.
I hate you. But no, it's not always about us. Like, we like to write in the third person as well, about other people. And you try not to make it just all about girls or the usual typical stuff. So when we go to write, we keep that in mind.
Well, look, when people are writing plays or films or whatever, you know, it's not biographical, and yet people expect songs to be biographical to come from, you know, you don't have to have lived through something to necessarily understand it, or to have the artistic ability to, you know, portray. It's going to mean something to someone.
Absolutely. That's what we definitely find. Even just talking to one of my friends recently spurred on one of our newest songs. You're just sitting there thinking, this isn't about me, but this is really interesting. It's something that I'd actually like to write about as well.
So what gigs have you got coming up?
Pepper Canister.
That's Wednesday, is it?
Yeah, it's funny. Where were we yesterday? And people were like, is it the Sugar or something? Because the last gig we did was Sugar Club, and now it's the Pepper Canister.
I blame who's ever naming these places. It's not your fault.
Making people hungry.
I know, the Pepper Canister. And it's a full-blown gig, is it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just us two again, so it's guitar and piano and the two vocals. But
there's a fantastic... That expectations of bells and whistles and 50 people on the stage is gone now. You know what I mean? Yeah. If you only have to look at, like, Ed Sheeran, just him and a guitar. Yeah, you know, I'm not making a comparison.
We'd love to take that back at some stage, though. We'd love to have a band at some stage.
Yeah, like, the idea would be to move it back.
But when you start, when you move, it just, you know, can you get to try and book in a load of guys, and then you have to hire in maybe the sound? You know what I'm on about? It's it's nice that you can still perform at a very high level, and then you can layer that on it.
Absolutely.
Into the future.
That was kind of the idea, because at the start of last year we had a band going into the studio, and then we decided we need to strip this back to go and write. And it actually worked out better for us, because we got great support slots, because we were two piece and we just put everything into the car and we're gone. That's it. You don't have to rely on loads of other people making it to somewhere.
What about sort of I presume then this festivals are going to be big for you this summer, or at least you'd hope they're going to be.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a fantastic way of getting your stuff out there, the festivals, isn't it?
Absolutely, but I kind of the way we are at the minute, the idea would be do the Pepper Canister gig, hopefully that goes great, and then off the back of that, see what happens. Because
I did get the feeling that you hadn't planned past Wednesday.
There is
one day at a time,
which is great. I mean, I think it's a brilliant way, because you know. Every day then it's exciting rather than sort of in 3 weeks this is happening and then, you know, like
it's worked out so far. I mean, we have a general idea after Pepper Canister. We want to do another EP, definitely, but we're kind of waiting on what other people say and who's interested in what we're doing to see what we want to do then. Do you know what I mean? If we get picked up by somebody, that'd be brilliant, and it'll completely change everything for us.
Well, all the right things are happening at this stage to sort of indicate that is what's going to happen.
Hopefully.
So and with your attitude, if it happens, brilliant. If it doesn't, you know, I mean, you're obviously able to adapt and evolve. Mm-hmm. So we're going to hear, we'll take a break and give you a chance to slip into the other studio. We're going to hear from, we're going to hear you sing It's Still Love. Great, you've had great exposure from this, haven't you?
Yeah, unbelievable. Yeah, it's done a lot of work for us.
You've been on RTE. Like, what kind of media have you done so far?
Today FM, 98 FM, or we're on Radio Spin. One the last day. We've done Spin. Yeah, we've done a lot of radio stuff.
Two Tube on RTE Two
nice as well. Yeah, no, it's been great. Yeah, people are really supportive, which is brilliant for upcoming bands.
And what's the reaction in Killybegs?
Yeah, it's weird, you don't, because you don't think about that when you're in Dublin, and you come back and people are like, oh yeah, blah blah blah, and they tell you what you're doing, you're like, oh my god, that's what's going on, and then you start to start sinking in, you're like, oh god.
I think you're having a brilliant time. I'm dead jealous. I mean, you know, like, there's no pretension, there's no nothing. Mm. it's just
good fun.
It's happening. Mm. I've been able to pack in my job, we're able to focus on this. You just get on.
Yeah. Well, kind of.
Sometimes. Okay, you're very good at acting like you're good at it. Listen, guys, John Doherty and Ryan McCluskey, I think he's going to be huge. And
I think lots of
people agree. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I will need it. Sometimes I won't, but I could never tell you, tell you, tell you. It's the love, it's the sound, it's no loss now. It's the love, it's the sound. Wow, that was Little Hours there. Absolutely fantastic. Donegal's own, Killybegs' own Little Hours. Guys, thank you so much for coming in. And in fairness to the guys, sounding absolutely brilliant there. But we don't have a full setup for them. So they've managed to get that sorted with a couple of mics that we use just generally for interviews. And it still sounded amazing. So we really appreciate them coming in. And next time we'll get a couple, hopefully. Cheers. Oh, you can hear me, can you?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
I have to say, that was brilliant.
Great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, really, really good. And is it going to win?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I heard there's this guy, Hosier, who's
a bit of I haven't heard of that fellow at all. Is a man or is that a band? I don't know.
I think he's from Dunleary, is he?
Hosier.
I think Killian Briggs is going to kick his ass. Cheers, guys.
Thank you very much.
That's John Doherty and Ryan McCluskey there. Brilliant guys. Little Hours. Get your hands on that single if you can and support them. And they've got that big gig coming up on Wednesday too. Right. We'll be back with more in the programme after this break. Actually, before we take the break, I want to get Pio in here because he's got another show coming up. Saturday's fantastic. You're going to have to sit around here, Pio, because we've had to shift that mic. I just want to hear what you've come up after 12 because it's another brilliant show.
Yes, Ayla Grant I have on today. She's got a new album, which I don't think is ready yet, but three tracks from it, and I'll be talking to her. She's on tour at the minute, you know. So I'm looking forward to that click, you know, because she's always come. She's so unique. She's different from everybody else. And
how
all,
is
you know.
She unique, Pio?
Well, she writes her own songs, and when you hear Ayla Grant, you won't hear them songs. Do you hear Ayla Grant again?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's what I like about her. She's so different. Either you like an act like that, or you don't like them. You know, some one of the
well,
two.
Like, look, she's
you
doing know what well, I mean? So but a she's lot proved, of
people she's like proven
her.
The point. Like you know, she's selling the. The units and you know, her tour in Australia and all has been very successful. Last one there, brilliant. We had her in Glasgow last year and she went down a storm there, you know.
Listen, so Ayla coming up between 12 and 2 in the best,
around about 1 o'clock.
Best of music,
the best of music is right.
That's
looking forward to that. You're very happy looking,
huh?
You're very happy. Looking. Enjoyed them two lads,
absolutely.
They're very, very good, very melodic and very tuneful.
Top class,
it just goes to show you the talent we have coming
it's
in this country.
And,
it's
astonishing,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really, really
and
is.
I don't think they're getting the right fair chance, you know what I mean?
I'm doing my best.
Oh, you are, you're doing. Your best, but there's a lot of radio stations that are not doing their best.
No,
and as far as Irish acts getting played, you take Hosier now number one in America.
Mm-hmm.
What more proof do you want than that? Did you ever hear him being played on the national stations before 6 months ago? No, you did not. So he's nobody to be grateful to or thank. He's done it all on his own.
That's where the independent radio stations have come to the.
That's where they're coming to the fore. They're helping everybody.
Yeah.
You know, but it's great to see that he's walked into America and sitting at number one today. It's just unbelievable.
Superb, Pio.
Loads of it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Your caller says, those lads are absolutely amazing. My daughter has just asked who they are. We are bowled over. They are. And you're welcome back. Now, the question being asked is, are you on a disability payment at present? If so, well, then there's a DAC training options course, which may be a good fit for you. To discuss this, we're joined by one of the tutors on that course, Julia Gavigan. Julia, firstly, perhaps you could explain to us a little bit about these courses.
Yes, well, this will be the fifth one that's going to be run in Letterkenny in the Congress Resource Centre. And it consists of three modules, Greg. The first one being computer literacy, and that gives you the basic kind of computer skills that you require. There's a personal interpersonal module, and that gives you a sense of self-awareness and social sensitivity to give people more confidence. And then the third module is work experience, and that is a program in the classroom and also a two-week work placement. And this is so that people can provide themselves with the skills and knowledge and be able to consider going back to work.
Mm. And who would you say would be a candidate for such courses or for this course?
Okay, this course is designed primarily for people who are in receipt of a disability allowance. So if you're in receipt of one of them, you're entitled to do this course for free without your payments being affected.
And even if your intention isn't necessarily to re-enter the workforce or perhaps you aren't capable of doing so for whatever reason, the course nonetheless sounds very worthwhile. Are people, in other words, anyone who qualifies, are they able to get on this course?
Absolutely. If you're in receipt of a disability payment, you're entitled to do this course regardless of your age or sex or gender. And basically... There's seven disability allowances. I mean, I could list them here, but if you're on a disability allowance, you'll know which one is yours. And there's a wonderful support network in the centre. There's myself and the rest of the team there. We get on so well in there. And the people who come into the course come from all walks of life, all different places around the county. And they come for a social aspect, to get into a kind of a routine as well, coming in Monday to Friday. From 9:30 to 1 o'clock, that's the hours of the course. And people just come and, you know, they get on so well with each other. And we've had nothing but good things to say about the course from our people who's left the course, you know.
And this is great work that you're doing in preparing people with a disability to get back into the working environment, if that's what they wanted to do with this course. There's also work needs to be done, do you think, as it relates to employers and perhaps seeing past a person's disability and focusing perhaps instead on what they can add to a business, for instance?
Absolutely. I mean, we do work very well with the local employers. I mean, that's part of one of the module is getting a lot of experience and some details from the local employers. The local employers are aware of certain grants available for people with certain disabilities, so that's to their advantage to employ someone. But there is also the aspect of that if people aren't ready to go back to work yet, Greg, then we're there to help them and to mentor them into maybe going on to a bit more further education to actually gain more skills to prepare them for when they do want to go back.
Well, that's all we have time for in the programme today. My thanks to everyone who contributed to it. It'll be online to listen back to very shortly at highlandradio.com. Thanks, as always, to Yvonne McFadden, who produced